All right, welcome into the Fan pregame. Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff, fresh off an appearance. Scotland. Some golf.
Dude, what a place. Oh, the history.
Exceptional.
The tradition.
The food?
The food is the food. The food's like...
The food's the food?
Yeah,
you don't go there for the
else,
food.
That's right. If everything else is like up here, the golf, the experience, being on the coast, all that stuff's fantastic. Even the weather was good. Like very little rain, if any. The food's like there, which is like fine. It's just a lot of like beef and carbs and
which
not
is,
much else.
Which is honestly probably what you need for a golf trip.
That's right.
Just to keep things... the pH levels as level as possible. The Oklahoma City Thunder probably dealing with some pH level imbalance right now, given that there was a championship celebration last night. Lots of champagne once they were able to open the bottles, but very cool seeing Shai Gilgeous-Alexander have another coronation because the season was all about him. And to recap that and to look ahead, let's bring in our first guest of the day, James Herbert, NBA writer, CBS Sports. Thanks for doing this, James.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's a pleasure. So, you know, the Oklahoma City Thunder, coronation, deserving champions, of course. But Game 7 was more than just the most dominant team in the NBA this season winning a title. There was also the Haliburton injury, and there was a comeback, or not necessarily a comeback, but a underdog story that I guess we didn't quite get to see through to the extent that we probably should have. So, when you're looking back on this series, 5 and 10 years, what will be the lasting memory for you? Will it be OKC finding a way and overcoming, you know, maybe the maturity issues of being there so soon in their timeline? Or will it be the fact that Tyrese Haliburton went down when he did?
I think for Game 7 specifically, unfortunately, it will be the Haliburton injury. I mean, it's hard to talk about that game without addressing it. I don't think this is how the Thunder wanted to finish off that series. I think they would have like obviously preferred to beat the Pacers at full strength. I think, you know, injuries are a part of the game. But the way this one happened, it did feel like sort of a crime against basketball. Like we're in the biggest stage imaginable. It's a Game 7 with a championship on the line. The way the game started, it seemed like we were going to get an all-time ending for what honestly to me is one of like my favorite finals series that I've watched. I mean, the Pacers gave the Thunder absolutely everything that they could handle. I thought Haliburton, despite the injury, started the game incredibly well, making those three threes. The Pacers still led by one at halftime, which is kind of wild, but ultimately, I mean, understandably, without their franchise player, without their leader, without the guy who sets the tone for everything that they do, I mean, their offense just kind of died against one of the best defensive teams in NBA history. So I'm not trying to take anything away from the Thunder, but if you're asking me like when I look back on this, what will I remember about like specifically how the series ended, I will kind of feel like we got robbed of what could have been like a real classic Game 7.
Yeah, that's a good follow-up, James. Good to see you, man. Is this the ultimate what-if moment in NBA history? I mean, there's a lot that you can go through over the course of time because injuries have played such a big role in many different big spots, but it feels like this one particularly, and you mentioned it, given the way that Haliburton even started this game, it felt like we were in store for another vintage performance from him, and then he goes down, and you see him slapping the court. It's just, I don't know how anyone could come away from this thinking like, if he was just healthy, we could have really been in for a barn burner down the stretch there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge what-if moment. It was a brutal way for the Pacers, kind of what had been a storybook season, for that to end. I mean, they had overcome so much to get to that point. You know, they had really coalesced into a team that was far more than the sum of their parts, a team that I think a lot of, you know, even casual NBA fans, they might not have watched a single Pacers game during the regular season. You could understand why they would get on board with this story. I mean, they overcame being the underdog, not just in the finals, but like pretty much all the way along. I thought the Cavaliers, who had an incredible regular season, were going to beat them in the second round. Now, the Cavs had some injury issues in that series, but I mean, the Pacers didn't just squeak by them. They demolished that team. They demolished a team that won 60-plus games, and then they came as close as you can get to then beating a team that to this point had been a historically dominant team in Oklahoma City and one of the best defenses I've ever seen in my life. And they did it by playing their way, by playing a style that is different than anybody else in the NBA. I think it's still an amazing story. I think there's still plenty that like other teams can learn from this Pacers team, just like there's plenty they can look at the Thunder of like what they did to get to this point and learn from. And I think this Pacers team will go down in history with some of the other sort of beloved teams that didn't win a title, at least this year. Like, I'm not saying they can't get back there. I mean, it probably won't be next year because Haliburton is going to, I mean, I assume miss the entire season because of the Achilles injury. But, you know, you think back to some of those Kings teams in the 2000s, the Suns teams led by Steve Nash that, I mean, have already drawn comparisons to these Pacers. I mean, I think people are going to have a fondness for this Pacers team, despite the fact that they didn't get the ending that they wanted.
So a torn Achilles off a calf strain, this has become routine now in the NBA, unfortunately. This has become, if not a routine, at least a pattern and a problematic pattern, I would say. Should these injuries be dealt with differently? Like, do they have to have serious discussions about how they're going to deal with strained calves specifically? Because, yeah, it's like an impossible situation. It's game 7 of the NBA Finals. You may never be back there. But it feels like you have to maybe save the athlete because the athlete is always going to make that decision, I want to play. And yet it just feels like the same result always happens when we are dealing with this injury. It feels like an unbelievable and sort of unsolvable problem in front of the NBA and I guess the NBA Players Union.
You're trying to bum me out with this topic of discussion. Yeah, I mean, it sucks. Like, this is the third one that we've seen. We've seen in 3 out of the 4 rounds of these playoffs, somebody going down, a star, an all-NBA caliber or just all-NBA player this year, going down with a devastating injury like this. This didn't used to happen to players who are young, approaching their prime or in their prime with any degree, this level of regularity. So it is alarming. I think this is something that is worthy of discussion. But I would say rather than focusing on kind of the treatment and how you react to the injury, because I don't want to put the blame on the Pacers. I don't know how you could tell somebody like Tyrese Haliburton, you just absolutely cannot play in a game 7 of the NBA Finals if he is comfortable with the risk. He did not go into these two games, game 6 and 7, kind of thinking that there was no possibility of sustaining an injury like this. But he, I think, was willing to live with it, judging by the comments that he made to reporters toward the end of this series. You want to avoid this. This is absolutely awful, but I think it's too easy to just say, oh, the Pacers medical staff should have told him, no, we're not going to let you out there. I think, to me, the bigger issue is prevention. How can you make sure that young players are not dealing with this and going down with this serious injury as regularly as we are seeing now? I think there are a lot of factors that go into it, but the solutions I don't think are nearly as complicated as sort of the reasons for this existing. I think the solutions are, you know, you need a shorter schedule, you need more time off between games, and you need to lower the workload on these guys. Like, these soft tissue injuries that the players are dealing with, not just Achilles tears, but a lot of the injuries that we've seen, a lot of these lower body injuries, they're overuse injuries. And players have never had to put this amount of strain on their lower body over the course of the history of the sport. And that is, I mean, from a young age in playing the amount that they do in AAU basketball. And that's also just in each individual game, the amount of ground that you're covering with the way that the game is played now. I mean, if you look at how these two teams specifically were playing in the finals, these are extraordinarily fast teams. These are also teams that are often pressing full courts. And then there are teams that are spreading the floor with 5 guys who can shoot. And the amount of side-to-side movements, the amount of strain and stress that you are putting on your joints, I mean, it's just not remotely the same as it was playing in the NBA 15, 20, 25 years ago.
It's almost like, who's going to be the person to tell Adam Silver that they got to dial it back from 82 to 76 or 72 games? It's just probably impossible because there's just too much money to be made. And, you know, when these big leagues are involved, that's usually how it goes. So let's brighten up the mood, though. Did Sam Presti just play this brilliantly? Like, he never got impatient enough where he traded all the picks that he had or young players to go out and get a veteran, maybe aging star. There was never that sort of, okay, I'm tired of this. The core was growing together, and he allowed it to happen to the point where now we talk about every year. It's like, oh, dynasty, the Nuggets won their championship. It's like, they're going to be a dynasty, the Celtics. Oh, it sets up well for them to be a dynasty. Of all of those teams, the Thunder have to be the most suited for actually turning this thing into a dynasty. And a lot of that goes back to the Sam Presti, just his, the moves that he's made starting with Paul George and then just letting it be and leaving it alone and now having 15 players under contract again. All the same players are all going to be back. And it just seems like it's setting up perfectly for them to remain not just relevant, but probably the best team in the league for quite some time here.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the job that Presti and the front office did in OKC. I mean, the Thunder are incredibly well positioned for the future, despite the fact they just won the championship last night. We've never seen a team this good that has this much sort of flexibility in terms of they're cheap right now. They won't always be cheap, but even when they get more expensive, they will have ways to get around that. Some of the contracts that they've signed, they've been front-loaded or descending. Some of the trades that they've made have ensured that they will still have extra draft picks coming their way in the coming years. I mean, they're structured like a rebuilding team, but what they are is a championship team.
It's crazy.
It is amazing. Now, they had some advantages, and I think it speaks to how opportunistic Presti was in this team build. Like, they started this with the Paul George trade. That's what set the table for everything. And by doing that, like, they were able to be patient while still being really good. He didn't overreact to, you know, people saying, oh, they need to trade for a center at last year's deadline or anything like that. But he wasn't on the other end of the spectrum where he's just like, I'm going to sit on my hands and do nothing. Like, they did go and add to the team last summer, but it was an opportunistic way. Like, they read the market and they saw, we can go get Isaiah Hartenstein. He will change the way that we play. He'll allow us to address our rebounding issue. He'll also allow us to change the way we play on the offensive end because we can run stuff through him. But they didn't have a player like him on the roster, and he allowed them to still be able to play super small and do that, but also go with this double big look that was really important for them at various times. They also traded young for old in a way that is not very I don't think people think of this as the Thunder's MO, right? But they did go and trade Josh Giddey for Alex Caruso last summer. And I think that was a reaction to Giddey not wanting to have a bench role. It was probably also somewhat of a reaction to how Giddey played in the playoffs last year. It was also just an incredible spot to add a guy in Caruso that just took nothing off the table for this team. But I think much like Hartenstein, like, added a new dimension. I mean, he extenuated all of their strengths. And I think on the offensive end also, like, an underrated part of him, obviously an incredible defender. That's the main thing he brings. But I think both of those two guys, so smart offensively, so unselfish, they're able to get more kind of flow and rhythm into the game. You didn't always see that. Sometimes the Thunder's offense got bogged down, but their defense was good enough that it didn't matter. But I think those two additions last summer were just, they were the right guys at the exact right time. And I think, yes, Presti's been incredibly patient, but I mean, he has also been opportunistic in sensing this is when I need to strike. Some people wouldn't have torn down the team when he did either, with that Paul George trade and the Russell Westbrook trade when he made it. But I think he just managed this all incredibly well the whole way through.
So he's got a couple draft picks to make, obviously, that being Sam Presti. But it'd be interesting to see if he just does nothing, like comes back with the exact same team. And usually it's not an option for a championship-level squad who's almost guaranteed to lose players. We're talking to James Herbert of CBS Sports. A lot of flattering comparisons for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander last night, winning the MVP of the finals. Of course, that's after an MVP season for the regular season. You know, you can attach his name to all these legends. But what's your favorite way to contextualize a season? Like, what for you, either what you've written, what you've heard, what you've seen, how he's being compared, best encapsulates what you saw from Shai this year? How do you best contextualize his MVP, MVP, MVP season?
So I'll lead off by saying I voted for Jokic for MVP this year. But
now you're bumming me.
Maybe I am. But I think the fact that, yeah, I voted for Jokic, and I don't feel bad about that now, by the way. He had an all-time season. And when Shai won, there was zero part of me that was like upset about that or like, oh, people got this wrong. Like, it was so close. Jokic had what I think, if you just look at the numbers and in particular, like look at the Nuggets numbers when he was on the court and look at how just, you know, kind of blah of a team they were in the non-Jokic minutes. Like, Jokic had I mean, in my mind, the best individual season that anybody has ever had among non-MVPs. And for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander to win that award in like kind of a landslide, if you look at how the first place votes were distributed and people not to be up in arms about it, like that to me is incredible. That tells you right there, Shai had an absolute all-time season, and he did it for a team that had an all-time regular season, and then were able to bring it all home and win the title and validate all of it. And he played an enormous role in that. I think we haven't even seen the best of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander yet. He is so young, but he put one of the best individual seasons together that any guard has had in NBA history. It's up there, like he's better than a lot of MVP seasons other people have put together. So yeah, I mean, I would start with the fact that like, I didn't even vote for him, but I was like, sure, this is totally fine. And then the fact that, you know, in the playoffs, they were in some tough spots and he managed to bring them home. Like you talked about what ifs. Game four was an enormous what if for Indiana. They were very close to going up 3-1 in the NBA Finals. And why didn't they? Some of it, the Thunder's defense was incredible in that fourth quarter. Also, Shai scored 15 points in a row and made like three really tough jumpers one-on-one and just made things happen, did the sort of stereotypical, almost cliche, out of a basketball movie stuff that stars are quote-unquote supposed to do. I mean, for him to do that and then at other moments in this series just like perfectly balances scoring and his playmaking. I thought last night in the clincher, his passing was as good as it had been at any point during his career. That's just really difficult to do on that stage with the Pacers defending him the way that they were.
What can Shai say to the haters? Because there has long been a contingent of NBA fans out there and even commentators. Like there are, I saw some charts today that ranked the Thunder as the least deserving champion of the last 10 years and the least impressive champion of the last 10 years. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the worst MVP that we've seen in a while. And we've heard the free throw merchant stuff and that he gets away with a lot of push-offs. But if you're the Thunder this morning and you're still hearing that kind of criticism, like what, I know you can just point to your finger and say, hey, I have a ring and we have the Larry O'B, but given the way that they play, like what is their comeback to those who say, they just happened to be in the right place at the right time?
I mean, I don't think they'll even have one. I think they'll just be happy with the rings that they're going to get on opening night next year and the trophy they got last night and all of the, you know, adoring fans that are going to be their parade. I don't think they're concerned about that at all. But I will push back on their behalf, though, because I think, yes, like I acknowledged earlier on, I think it was kind of a bummer that we did not get a Thunder versus Pacers at about full strength last night. We didn't get a game that came down to the wire that was this classic. But the Thunder were the best team in the NBA from pretty much right the beginning, the opening week of the season until now. They are historically dominant in terms of having like the best point differential literally since like we can track it. Their defense, again, is like just something that the NBA could not solve that I think was the most, you know, swarming, disruptive, just unbelievable defense I've ever seen. The way that they made opposing teams uncomfortable, the way that teams that normally were, you know, really patient and smart and adaptable offensively. Like I'm thinking about the Pacers, obviously the way that they have, they almost never turn over the ball. I'm thinking about the Nuggets, the way that they operate with Jokic. Like the Nuggets at the end of that series could not even like initiate their offense, could not get Jokic the ball with the way the Thunder were defending. The Pacers at various times looked like they had never played basketball together before. I mean, the way they started that series in game one, they eventually came back and won it. But that first quarter, they were turning it over virtually every time down. And you saw there were pockets of this series where they reverted to that. And that's because of how special the Thunder are as a team. I mean, I don't really think Shai has to say anything. I don't think the Thunder will really care to address their haters after they won. But I mean, for me, like, they were the massive favorites going into this for a reason. It didn't always look beautiful offensively in the half court, like in this series, but the same has been true of many recent champions. Think about the Raptors offense, particularly when they were playing against the Sixers on the way to their title. Look at
the Lakers half court offense on the way to their title in the bubble. They stole a lot of games just through getting extra possessions. The same with the Bucks. They at times, like, it was like really grimy and ugly on the way to their championship. That's how it is. It is not supposed to be easy. It is not supposed to be pitch perfect and beautiful on every possession. I think the Thunder had their identity. They played to it. They were built for playoff basketball, and they were able to win their way.
Last one for you, James. We appreciate the time. Very, very generous with it tonight. The Rockets get Kevin Durant, and the Thunder are prohibitive favorites to not just go back to the NBA Finals, but to win, I think, plus 220 in most spots around that range. But the Houston Rockets were the number two seed. They just add a Hall of Fame scorer, and still, despite his age, one of the most purest hoopers there is in the league. Does this change the calculus in the Western Conference? Does this make the Rockets more viable as a number two seed trying to improve on their position last year?
I think so. I think the Rockets were just a super impressive team last year. I think they found an identity sort of similar to what the Thunder did, just in terms of they were super tough, super physical, incredible on defense, kind of building on what they had done the year before. I think they went from a 10th best defense in the league to the fifth best. And also when they played big, I mean, they were just bullying teams on the inside. Nobody could get in the paint against them. Nobody could grab a rebound on either end against them. But their demise was because they couldn't score, especially when they were playing those big lineups. And they sometimes had Amen Thompson out there with the two bigs. They just could not space the floor. To now have a guy who will not only help their floor spacing, one of the best shooters and scorers that has ever lived, but is also a guy that is uniquely qualified to, even if he does have to play in a phone booth, even if the spacing is not perfect, he can just rise up over guys and get them a bucket. To have a guy who, when they're playing against really good defense, like the defense they saw from the Warriors in the first round of the playoffs, they can just give him the ball at the end of the shot clock and say, like, try to bail us out. Like, he is one of the best to do that in the history of the sport. So I think absolutely he raises their ceiling. And I think crucially, they didn't have to destroy the identity and the infrastructure they had built to get him. Like, when there were rumors about Houston trading for Durant going back to last summer and then midseason, I wasn't always the biggest fan of it just based on his age and their timeline. But the price was supposed to be a lot bigger then. So once it was Jalen Green, Dylan Brooks, and this top 10 pick, and like that's essentially what Phoenix got here. I think it kind of would have been crazy not to do it, because think of what they still have on the roster. They can have Tari Eason basically play the role that Dylan Brooks played for them. Without Jalen Green there, okay, like, now there's more minutes for Reed Shepard. You still have Fred VanVleet. There's more minutes for Amen Thompson to play in the backcourt instead of having to make him this like weird, you know, kind of point center or a four for them. I think they have a much more balanced team in terms of offensively and defensively, what they can accomplish, even if they now have a team that from an age perspective is a little bit out of whack. I don't think the price that they paid was prohibitive in this sense. So I was all for it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, it was painful watching them try to score in the playoffs. And with Kevin Durant, that should change a little bit. Hey, James, we appreciate the time tonight. And we'll chat again next season.
That was awesome.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
That's James Herbert, CBS Sports. It should be an interesting NBA summer. I am, like, the Thunder, not the rest on the laurels thing, clearly, and they are favorites for a reason, but there were some things that they could improve on, of course.
Three-point shooting.
You know, like, it was a problem for the Rockets to score. It was a problem for the Oklahoma City Thunder to score outside of J-Dub and Shea at times in these playoffs. So we'll see if they do anything, because they don't have to do anything. They just enjoy each other and what they've got and the infrastructure and the fact that they're all going to get championship rings on night one, or they can try to be better. And I think there are avenues to improve if you're Presti. So we'll see what the Thunder do.
Yeah, they're literally going to have to trade away draft picks because they don't have room on their roster. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how deep and how good they are. They got 15 and 24 in the first round this year. Like, they're just set up perfectly. And just so everyone knows, it wasn't a straw man when I asked people about the Thunder, or I asked James about the Thunder not getting respect. Colin Coward was the one who ranked the last seven NBA champions and the Raptors were seventh.
Oh, I thought the Raptors were out of the basement there.
And then six was the 2025 Oklahoma City.
Okay,
Thunder.
So the bubble Lakers are getting ahead of both the
they were
the
one,
Raptors,
which is just absurd. So Thunder. What do you get?
They were one?
The Lakers, yeah.
Okay. And we will...
That invalidates the whole
list.
We
will move on. We're going to have Atlanta Rizzo on the other side. The Blue Jays are off tonight after a disappointing weekend. We'll tee up, I guess, an off night for the Blue Jays before we talk to Alana. But let's get into some bets for tonight. I don't really have a bet per se, but I think the most interesting market may have been unveiled in a long time last night. Who's going to win the Eastern Conference next year? I don't have a clue. Right now, the Cleveland Cavaliers are favorites. Of course, they were the number one seed in the Eastern Conference and should be bringing the band back, despite, you know, maybe the plans were different. But with this offseason, with Jason Tatum and Tyrese Halliburton hurt, maybe they're going to force themselves to just run it back and see if they can get a different result. The Knicks, Magic, who got Desmond Bane, Boston Celtics without Tatum, 76ers have the fifth shortest odds. And then you get to the Pacers, who are at about 16-1 right now. And I know Halliburton likely is not going to factor in until
at all
maybe this time next year. Yeah. Like, it's going to be really, really difficult for him to have any impact on next year. But I still think that team,
they kind of
without him,
they kind of cooked for a little bit last night until the fourth.
Exactly. They're an impressive group, and they can actually make, you know, changes to the roster to try and offset the loss of Halliburton. So I think the Pacers are a little interesting at 16-1, given that everybody else seems to have issues or, you know, just immaturity in their own right. So I think the Pacers at 16-1 isn't terrible. If Halliburton, if they lost, Halliburton played, they lost, he's back next year, they're probably 2-1.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in the Pacers.
I like that. I like it a lot. It's just so bizarre how it feels like our entire lives, the East has always been more wide open than the West. Like, the West is where the big boys come to play. And I get the Celtics. Yeah. Teams have won from the East, obviously, many times before, but it always felt like the
doesn't
West
look like there's a championship winner in this list.
No.
Like, you're falling to someone in the West, likely, but who's going to get there? I think, yeah, like, you can make an argument for 10 teams. By the way, the Raptors are 70-1 with the 10th shortest odds.
I mean, sneaky. Raptors fans are going to be pumped going into next season.
They're trying to dangle that 10th overall pick or 9th overall pick.
All right, I'm going to go completely different sport. We're going Juan Soto to hit a homer tonight, plus 390. He's got three homers in his last six games. And when a guy like that starts to heat up, you follow the trend. And his batting average has been raised about 10 points in the last five games. He's starting to cook big time. The Mets need it, obviously, coming off of that ugly seven-game losing streak. And I expect him against the Braves to keep that hot streak going. Juan Soto to hit a home run.
Yeah, I've heard less Mets fans complaining, so it must mean that Juan Soto is turning things around.
Yep.
We will touch on the NL, the Jays, getting Max Scherzer back this week with Alana Rizzo on the other side of Fair Territory. That's next.
Hey, it's Ben Ennis.
And I'm Brent Gunning.
We got you covered on all things Leafs, Raptors, and Blue Jays every weekday morning, 6 to 9.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back on the Fan pregame. The Blue Jays are off tonight after a disappointing weekend, dropping 2 of 3 at home to the lowly Chicago White Sox. A six-game road trip ahead with stops in Cleveland and Boston. Cleveland is pretty key. Cleveland's 1.5 games back of the Blue Jays, who are in a wild card position. But I guess the headliner is Max Scherzer making his second start for the Blue Jays on Wednesday. Hasn't pitched since March 29th. He lasted 3 innings, and it felt somewhat ominous the way he described his return. He told Sportsnet, "My stuff is fine. I'm trying everything I can to manage this thumb and make sure I can recover. There's no knowing. I just have to get out there." So he's just going to get out there on Wednesday, and we'll see if that digit can hold up.
Fine. Not the word you want.
No.
Necessarily.
Hopefully, he said the warmer weather is a little easier on the thumb. So maybe we're certainly warm enough in Toronto.
It's like Tiger. You can't play in cold weather.
A little bit more limber.
Limber up,
that thumb. Okay, let's bring in Alana Rizzo of Fair Territory, talk about the Blue Jays and the other happenings in Major League Baseball. Alana, thanks for doing this. Let's start with Scherzer. You know, the thumb is the thumb. It feels like a thing that's just going to hang over this entire season. But the Blue Jays need a boost, a shot in the arm. They're legitimate in a wild card and division race at the moment. We know there's some starting pitching issues. And if Max Scherzer can just survive this start, it seems like that'll be a real big thing for the Blue Jays.
So funny. A couple of interesting adjectives, fine and survive. That's exactly what you think of when you think of Max Scherzer, right, guys? Good to be with you as always. I appreciate you having me on. Yeah, I mean, this is a different Max Scherzer than the Max Scherzer that was with the Washington Nationals, even the Max Scherzer that was with the Dodgers early on in that stint with them, and certainly the Max Scherzer that was with the Detroit Tigers prior to the Nats. But yeah, I mean, this is not the ace anymore. I mean, this is a guy that's going straight to Cooperstown when he does decide to hang it up, but this is not the same guy that got him to Cooperstown, right? So if you can just give you a boost, if he can stay healthy, if the finger is okay, if he can give you, I think if you get five innings out of Max Scherzer, six would be amazing. You certainly don't know what you're going to get from a guy coming off of the IL, but he doesn't even see. I mean, the thing about Max Scherzer, he's always been brutally honest about his body and the way that things feel, but it's fine. Doesn't bode a lot of confidence, but hopefully he can get you five innings. That would be great, because it would give a boost to that rotation for sure.
Well, the Blue Jays offense has gotten a wee bit better since the beginning of the season, when they were basically parked in the bottom five in terms of runs scored. And even now, when you look at their run differential, they're still in negative territory. So you can count me among those who are still tentative believers in the Toronto Blue Jays, despite the fact that they're currently in a wild card spot. What does the greater baseball world have to say about the Toronto Blue Jays, though? Because in this market, there's still, I think, a little bit of iffiness surrounding this team. What does the rest of baseball think?
There's a couple of things, and I don't want to speak for the rest of baseball, but I still have a tremendous amount of respect for the Toronto Blue Jays and a tremendous amount of belief in the Toronto Blue Jays. You mentioned the run differential. It's at negative 10 right now. That's not great, but at least it's not like negative 100, you know, or negative whatever. They're right in striking distance of being, let's start with even. We'll get there first, and then we'll hopefully have a positive run differential. This team is too good to be where they're at right now. That being said, though, guys, if the season ends today, they still have a 1.5 game lead hold on a wild card spot. So you're in the postseason, and that's all you can ask for right now, right? You want to try to maintain. Obviously, you would love to create some distance in the division, and that, I do believe, is still a possibility, considering that just a couple of weeks ago, I thought that the Yankees were running away with the AL East. But you see that the way that the Yankees have played over the course of the last couple of weeks, and you see, I understand the last series notwithstanding, but Toronto was playing better. Tampa Bay certainly was playing better. The Boston Red Sox were playing a lot better. The Orioles, to me, are done. But I do believe that Toronto still has an opportunity to make up some ground in an AL East division that is no longer just a one-horse race. So I think the rest of the baseball world still has belief that the Toronto Blue Jays certainly can contend. Will they win the AL East? Probably not. But can they certainly gain some ground on a wild card spot? I do believe so.
Talking about run differential, I noted that the Tampa Bay Rays are 80 runs better than the Blue Jays at current moment, which sounds almost unbelievable given that only two games separate them in the division and wild card race at the moment.
Think about where they play, though. What's that? Think about where Tampa Bay plays.
I guess that's the answer. So how legitimate are the Rays? Like, it's the same sort of conversation as it normally is, but like, it works both ways unless the Rays are perfectly suited to play in their ballpark. So like, how do you view them given the extra context of their season, but also I guess the expectations weren't necessarily high on this team, but they're certainly performing like a team that's worth keeping an eye on.
But the thing is, the Tampa Bay Rays never have expectations that they're going to do anything, right? But the Tampa Bay Rays are the one flipping team that's in this postseason, at least the postseason hunt, every single year. And there's only one team that can run the way that the Rays do it, and it's the Rays. I mean, there's other teams that have tried to take a page out of the Tampa Bay Rays book in terms of how we're going to run our franchise. All of a sudden, the Red Sox want to be the Rays, and it does not work. Tampa Bay has the formula down pat. They invented the formula, and it works for them. I think they're benefited, obviously, not necessarily in terms of aesthetics and, you know, being taken care of, but they're benefited by that park and playing, obviously, at Steinbrenner Field there in Tampa, much more than the Athletics, obviously, are in Sacramento, even though both parks, obviously, are band boxes, and there's a lot of offense at both of those parks. But Tampa Bay is a good team. They always are, and they do it with a very low budget for the most part, but they've always had good starting pitching, and I really do believe of all of the teams in Major League Baseball, of all 30, Tampa is who they are on paper, right? It's like that old Dennis Green saying, we are who we thought we were. I feel like that is who Tampa Bay is. And I think they're legitimately as good as their record states, whereas some other teams are either better than their record is or worse than their record is. And I think Tampa Bay is as good as what is on paper right now.
What do you think about seeing Shohei Ohtani back on the mound? I mean, he looks pretty sharp. And I almost want to say, like, do the Dodgers even need it, considering how good they are and how loaded they are? But they have had their fair share of pitching struggles so far this year. So what does the rest of the year look like for Shohei Ohtani, assuming all things health-wise are fine? Like, is he going to play a very valuable role from the mound for the Dodgers when it comes to important games in September and October?
I think it's putting it mildly that the Dodgers have had pitching struggles. They are decimated with pitching injuries in terms of the starting pitching, and now really even the bullpen too. I mean, if you think about going into the season, guys, what we thought that Los Angeles Dodgers were going to have in terms of a starting rotation, you thought that they were going to have Tyler Glasnow, right? You thought that they were going to have Blake Snell. I mean, that was like the really big name, the first big, huge name off of the board in terms of starting pitching, and the Dodgers landed him. And then you're like, oh my gosh, not only do we have those guys, but by the way, we got the highly coveted Roki Sasaki that was able to sign with LA from Japan to complement Yoshinobu Yamamoto. And obviously we knew that Shohei Ohtani was coming back. Well, Glasnow's on the IL. Blake Snell is on the IL. Roki Sasaki is on the IL. Clayton Kershaw is back and he's pitched well. He's getting ready to hit another milestone in terms of 3,000 career strikeouts. But you don't have necessarily Yamamoto being an ace every single time out, and you're having to rely upon the Dustin Mays of the world, the Justin Robleskis of the world, you know, these other guys that are kind of being spot started and filling in the gaps. So yes, Shohei Ohtani is such a unique situation because nobody has ever done this before. So it's not as if you can send him out on a rehab start. And he said, you know what, instead of pitching in these simulated games, instead of trying to do things in the bullpen or the side sessions, let me do this in game at the big league level against major league hitters. What was interesting though is his first outing of the season, Shohei Ohtani threw 28 pitches. His second outing of the season, he threw 18. And I'm not a major math whiz, but 28 to me is more than 18. So if you're thinking about ramping him up, it almost seems a little strange that he threw 28 in his first outing and then 18 in his second. But this is such a unique situation with Shohei Ohtani that you have to trust the training staff, you have to trust the front office, and you have to trust Shohei, right? I mean, Shohei is the one that wanted to face big league hitters in game situations. So yes, I do think he is going to be a force moving forward. We're almost at the halfway point of the season for the Los Angeles Dodgers and for the rest of the league. So I do think he's going to play a critical part in the second half of the season, obviously with the bat, but also on the mound.
Yeah, there's no roadmap for this, right? This is a completely unique situation, and we'll see. We're kind of in the dark. Like, what are the intentions? What do they want? What's the end goal? What does Shohei want? I guess we're going to find out from start to start, and maybe there will be ascending amounts of pitches next time for Shohei Ohtani. We're talking to Alana Rizzo about the Blue Jays and beyond Major League Baseball. There are a lot of great tournaments in sports. I'm partial to the Stanley Cup playoffs, NCAA tournament's good. We just saw the College World Series. That's another good tournament. But I feel like the National League playoffs this coming October might just set like a new high bar. Are we gearing up towards, with the Dodgers, Phillies, and Cubs leading their division, the Padres on the outside looking in right now, like, is this going to be an all-time section of the bracket, I guess, in terms of what we see, like the pennant in the National League this year, the fight for it, the rivalry, the bad blood we're already seeing between the Padres and Dodgers this year. Like, is this going to be an all-timer come October?
I think it's going to be incredibly interesting. I think there's nobody that will argue that the National League is way stronger and way better than the American League as far as the leagues are concerned in Major League Baseball. And there's a lot more teams in the National League that are vying for those postseason spots. And even with the three wildcard spots, there's a lot more teams in the National League that could contend for those, right? I think the American League has a much clearer path. And it's interesting too, because I've had this conversation at length in terms of, you know, who is the biggest competitor? Who's the biggest threat to the Dodgers in the National League West? And who's the biggest threat to the Dodgers? And I only say that because they were in the World Series last year. We can say the same thing about the New York Yankees, right? I still think the Padres are the biggest threat for the Dodgers in the National League West, even though the Giants are playing unbelievably well. They have a great pitching staff and they just got Rafael Devers, right? So the Giants have played well. The Padres are sinking a little bit. But I do still think that the Padres are the biggest threat for the Dodgers in the division. Now, nationally, overall, there's a lot of teams vying for that spot. I think it's a lot easier now, obviously, with the wild card spots. But I think the competition and the parity in terms of the National League, I mean, the Cubs are incredibly good. The Mets have struggled, but they're still incredibly good. The Phillies, the Giants are still going to be in it. I mean, Arizona has tapered off quite a bit. I think I just mentioned the Cubs, but they're good too. So it's much more difficult in terms of a path to the postseason in the senior circuit than it is in the junior circuit for sure.
Over in the American League, Cal Raleigh is on pace for 66 home runs. I mean, 66 home runs. Like, where did this power output come from? From the big dumper, because it is.
Yeah, I was going to say the big dumper, right? I don't know.
It's preposterous.
I think we know where the power is coming from.
There you go. He's got a 4-home run lead on Aaron Judge. Like, is there any chance at all that Cal Raleigh, you know, chases down Aaron Judge for American League MVP? I mean, if he hits 66 home runs, like, he's got to be. It's got to be right there.
The conversation, right? And I think the thing about that too is that, I mean, Aaron, anybody that plays for the New York Yankees, it's an automatic conversation piece, right? Because, oh, it's the Yankees, and everybody just automatically gives you that credibility. Seattle Mariners don't have as much credibility and as much cachet as the New York Yankees do, but what Cal Raleigh is doing this quickly into the 2025 season, particularly as a catcher, I mean, you almost expect that from a right fielder, right? But as a catcher, I think it's pretty incredible what Cal Raleigh has been able to do in terms of numbers. We've known that the Seattle Mariners have had an unbelievable starting pitching staff for several years now. And Cal Raleigh is a part of that, right? He's the backstop. He's the guy like leading his pitching staff through the game. But what he's been able to do offensively, it's like he has rewarded them for the massive contract they gave him right before the season started time and time again. I mean, he's paid dividends for them all season long. You would have to absolutely put him in the American League MVP conversation just because of everything that he's done offensively, but also the fact that he's a catcher. Seattle is very much in the race. I mean, it would be different if, you know, he was doing all of this stuff for an American League team has absolutely no shot in the world, or if he was, you know, doing these types of numbers for the Cincinnati Reds or the Colorado Rockies, he's probably not going to get as many votes. But the fact that he's on a team that is contending to get into the postseason and he's putting up unbelievable numbers, and the fact that he's a catcher, he has to be in the conversation.
One more before we let you go. Of course, the National League is a murderer's row of quality teams. It leaves something to be desired, as you mentioned, in the American League. I think Junior Varsity might have been your take on it. But that leaves an opportunity, right? Like, you might have to beat only one truly quality team potentially to get to a World Series. If you had to pick one team to get aggressive ahead of the deadline, make sure that you're not leaving anything to chance as you try to reach a World Series, win a pennant. Who would you like to see be aggressive in the American League to make sure that their roster is as best it can be for the stretch drive?
I mean, you know that there's the teams that are automatically going to do it. You know the Yankees are going to do it. You know that there's teams that are just, it's a given that they're going to do it. I would love to see the Detroit Tigers go all in on, I mean, they are a really, really good team. They have been all season long. I think they kind of took the momentum, you know, the last 2-3 weeks of the season last year, and they've kind of taken it into this season. I think they are as good as advertised. I know they struggled this past series. They did win on Sunday, but the point is the Tigers are really, really good, and they're a young team. Javi Baez is like Benjamin Button all of a sudden. He's like playing like the Javi Baez of old of when they, you know, he got those huge contracts. I would like to see Detroit go all in and absolutely be as competitive as possible moving into the postseason. Barring anything absolutely catastrophic, I still think they win the AL Central, and I absolutely think they end up probably with the best record in the American League and get the highest seed. I'd love to see them go out at the deadline and plug any and all holes that they possibly have at that point.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the American League arms race looks like, because you're right, the Tigers should be going, and we know about the Yankees, and the Blue Jays are going to be involved as well, unless Max Scherzer's thumb feels great after Wednesday's start. We'll see.
No, it feels fine.
We'll see how fine it really is. Alana, we appreciate the time. We will do this again soon.
Okay, take care, guys. Great to be with you. Bye-bye.
That's Alana Rizzo of Fair Territory. Okay, couple trades in a couple leagues. Mm. Kevin Durant, of course, as we talked about, going to the Houston Rockets, but also Trevor Zegras going from the Anaheim Ducks to the Philadelphia Flyers in exchange for Ryan Poehling and a couple draft picks, including the 45th overall pick this year.
Yeah.
Which of those two trades is more interesting to you?
You know, honestly, I think if you asked me this, it would be the same. It's Kevin Durant. I mean, Zegras started out his career doing some really impressive things. Like, he was the brash young star in Anaheim, and you were thinking, oh, this team might actually be able to accomplish something if this guy's becoming the face of the team, and he was one of the young faces of the league. But his play has really dropped off since then. He's got 32 points in 57 games a year ago with the Ducks, 15 and 31 the year before when he had, in his rookie season, 61 in 75. So, it doesn't move the needle, but hopefully, you know, he can find some more success somewhere else. Maybe it's one of those situations where a young guy needs to go somewhere else, get a fresh start and see where it goes. But I mean, even Durant at this advanced age for an athlete, even for life these days,
a couple like being the same age as Kevin Durant is kind of hurtful, or being in that ballpark, hurtful, but go ahead.
No doubt. He still can do it. And I think he needs to be in the right situation as well. It felt like Phoenix got a little bit toxic there because they just couldn't win. And it felt like even the fan base started to turn on him at certain points. But I want to see if he still has it. Like, does he still have that drive, that ability to, when it really matters, I'm going to be Kevin Durant and I'm going to drag my team over the line. And for a team like Houston to get a guy like that, being the 2 seed last year and not really giving up all that much to get him, it'll be exciting to see how that translates for Kevin Durant.
Yeah, Kevin Durant's career since the Golden State Warriors being almost meaningless.
Forgettable.
Like, weird. Spinning tires. Yeah. Like, this is an all-time great player.
Exactly.
Who's basically not played on any team of consequence for a very long time now. It's just going through the motions, it seems like, in the late stages of his career. Not fun. So I hope that the Rockets will be a good team. They gave up basically nothing to get Durant. Durant, unless he's unable to perform on the court, is going to be a factor this year because the Houston Rockets are in a position to be a really good team. It's number 2 seed. Clearly, there's some deficiencies. He fills some of those deficiencies. It means more in the grand landscape or the grand scheme of things than Trevor Zegras going to the Philadelphia Flyers. But it is interesting because it feels like Zegras was sort of painted unfairly, probably, as like part of the unserious nature of the Anaheim Ducks for the last couple of years.
For sure.
Now he goes to Philly, and he feels so anti-Philly in so many ways, and anti-Talkett in so many ways. Mm-hmm. But that team is so desperate for some actual talent, some scoring talent. They're still so far away, it seems, from being truly competitive. But this is kind of stopgap, too, because Trevor Zegras has 1 year left, RFA, at the end of the season. $6 million he's paid. Like, it's going to be really difficult for him to meet that and actually get more in restricted free agency than his current contract. I'm fascinated to see how it works. But, yeah, Devin Durant going to Houston, more interesting and is going to be weighing more consequential in what happens next year.
It's crazy to even say this, but it feels like Durant could use one more last notch on his belt. Like, even the Warriors championship, it feels like he wasn't carried by any means, but there are still people who look at it and say, hey, you took kind of the easy road to win, you know, titles in the NBA.
His best moments have been in almost no lose situations.
Yeah.
Like, clearly winning an NBA title is hard. Winning an Olympic gold medal, I suppose it's become more difficult for Team USA, but his finest moments in terms of championship glory have been assisted by other truly great players, not exclusively on the back
Definitely. Of
Kevin Durant.
So if a 36-year-old Kevin Durant can drag the Houston Rockets to the finals or even win a championship, then that would be the final thing that can be the end point, the exclamation point on Kevin Durant's Hall of Fame, incredible career. One of the best scorers of all time, without question.
It feels A little far-fetched, though.
Yeah.
Given his age.
Yes.
Rubinov. Very quickly, you just came back from Scotland. We started. Let's finish it. Do you have a highlight in 30 seconds to give us?
I mean, walking around the 18th fairway of St. Andrews. There's no doubt. Like, it's just the history, the tradition, and the fact that they allow you to just walk on the fairway when people aren't playing anymore is just... It's preposterous.
It's just like, it just happens at all hours because they basically sun doesn't go down, so people are just doing all day.
I was taking sunset photos with the 18th green right there at 11 o'clock.
TV.
11 o'clock at night.
Okay, still to come tonight, Yankees and Reds on Sportsnet. Boston will visit the LA Angels on Sportsnet 1. You can also find Cubs and Cardinals on Sportsnet Plus. We'll be back tomorrow to continue leading up to the NHL draft on
Love Friday. It.